Good afternoon. Today is Tuesday, January 18th, 2022, 5:30. I would like to call the public hearing to order. We'll be discussing the grant administration of the New York State Community Development Block Grant, CDBG award for Tompkins County Healthy Homes Rehabilitation Program 3. Are there any comment cards? Anyone like to speak on behalf? Okay, thank you.
The first one should be, yeah, Megan.
I can just provide a very quick background. This is our second public hearing for the county's Community Development Block Grant Award for Housing Rehabilitation. It was awarded in 2019 by New York State Homes and Community Renewal. The grant should be ending, we're anticipating, by the end of April this year. And with the pandemic, the state allowed us to repurpose some of these funds for emergency rental assistance in 2020, and that program ran through late summer of 2021. And this hearing is just an opportunity if any members of the community have any questions, concerns, things they'd like to share about the administration of the program.
Thank you, Megan.
And we also have Delia Yarrow from INHS, who is serving as the county subrecipient, delivering the program in the day-to-day on the Zoom as well, if you all have any questions or would like an update or anything.
Thank you very much. Hello, Delia. Would you like to add comments to our public hearing?
Sure. I just want to say that I don't even know where to start. We worked really hard on repurposing money for emergency rental purposes, and we're very proud to have helped a lot of our community members, folks with up to 3 months' rent. That was the maximum allowed under this funding requirement. So we didn't use all of the funding remaining in the grant. We moved some back, and now we're currently helping a bunch of homeowners with repairs again. So this funding has been used for what the county determined was the most urgent needs at the time, and we did our best in terms of administering it and trying to get it to folks through the pandemic. It's been very complicated to find contractors to be in folks' homes to administer the emergency rental, but I think we'll be able to get through this on time. So that feels like a win.
Good. Thank you. We have Mike Sigler making comment. And I also had one other speaker, Laura Lee Morrow, who had signed up to speak. And I just want to make sure if she was here that we give her the opportunity.
She's here. I'm trying to promote her to panelist.
Okay.
Hi, this is Laura Lee. I'm just letting Delia speak. I'm just here in case she needs some support. She ran most of the program for INHS.
Great. Thank you very much. Kathy, are there any more comments?
No, Donna, there's not.
Okay. I would like to close the public hearing. Next, if I could call for another public hearing to order, a local law increasing the compensation of the Tompkins County Sheriff. And Dominic or Kathy, do we have anyone here for public comment?
I did not have anyone sign up.
Okay. I would like to close the public hearing. Okay. I would like to welcome everyone to the Tompkins County Legislature meeting, Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. And if you could join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for
Thank you all. Roll call of members.
Randy Brown.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Henry Granison.
Here.
Rich John.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Here.
Mike Lane. Here. Mezzi.
Here.
Capilla.
Here.
Lee Shirtless.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Travis Brooks.
Here.
With 14 members present.
Thank you, Kathy. We do not have any presentations of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. I would ask that legislators look in their red folders, however. We will have an executive session this evening regarding personnel matters, and that is referring to a particular employee. There is not an action that's expected to happen whenever we come out of executive session. Now let's move on to privilege of the floor for the public. And I would like to go over some rules for speaking under privilege of the floor. Number one, an individual may speak no longer than 3 minutes. Two, a speaker will not raise their voice. A speaker will not use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libellous language, or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of the peace. Number four, a speaker will not speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about job performances of named county employees other than elected officials. Number five, after 3 minutes, a speaker will leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. Number six, a speaker will not cause a disruption, and if asked to leave, will leave the Zoom or chambers. And do we have anyone here for our public comment? Okay. I have three people that have signed up. First is Nevin Sabet.
Nevin is not on yet.
Okay. Next, Zach Nguyen.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
My name is Zachary Nguyen. I've spoke at several of these legislature meetings regarding the COVID mask and vaccine mandates. I'd like to encourage all of the members of the legislature there to seriously consider whether or not these are wise policies to continue to pursue. I personally have left a job because I was not willing to work in front of a 600-degree oven in a mask, completely unnecessarily, I might add. I'd like to point you to the CDC acknowledging that cloth masks are absolutely pointless when it comes to dealing with a virus. And I'd like to ask the legislature, specifically Rich John, who's a lawyer as far as I understand, if the federal mask and vaccine mandate that was put forth through OSHA is unconstitutional because it could not be done through, you know, a typical process of passing a law. Why is the New York State mask and vaccine mandate any less unconstitutional or invalid? I believe it is a flawed policy. And, you know, as the midterms approach, there's the pretty obvious attempt to walk back some of these COVID measures due to the, you know, if you look at the polling numbers, you'll see what I'm saying about as far as people leaning Republican due to the failed policies surrounding COVID. So I was really hoping that you folks could put your heads together and maybe reconsider, you know, the effectiveness of these policies. And whether or not it's benefiting the community and yourselves and your various parties as a whole. And, well, I had previously asked Veronica Piller if the tactics of showing up at the homes of various public officials, which she and her allies at the Ithaca Tenants Union and Ithaca Democratic Socialists, so on and so forth, they utilized that tactic. And I was wondering if she and the rest of the members of the legislature believe that's an appropriate way to communicate to your public officials, to show up unannounced at their homes and, you know, make your voice heard. If that's the way to get through to my local officials, you know, I'd like to know that, because I've tried traditional avenues and they don't seem to have gotten me anywhere. So please end the masks. COVID is just the flu with a better publicist, and masks are not effective. Thank you.
Okay, next is Robert Lent.
Good evening. Robert Lynch, 175 Gray Road, Town of Enfield. I'm a member of the Enfield Town Board. I'm speaking tonight as an individual. I first want to congratulate the legislature on appointing Shauna Black as its chair. Very good choice. Shauna has been very helpful for us in Enfield as with COVID-19 matters and helping the county with COVID-19 matters, helping us get our handle on this pandemic and trying to get it behind us. In that regard, I would like to urge the legislature tonight to ratify a measure that went through committee earlier, well, actually last month, resolution number 10610, which will help in the fight against COVID-19. That said, I want to get to my central point. 6 days ago, I attended via YouTube a meeting of a Tompkins County Administrative Agency, a board on which two of our county legislators attended as members. As at least one of them knows, I harbor strong disagreement with how the agency conducted its business that day. Unilaterally and without notice, an agenda item was expanded to include a much more controversial issue, a multi-million dollar pilot abatement for a financially fragile, long-delayed downtown apartment project was extended. I would like to have addressed that matter. Maybe others would have too, yet we found no opportunity to do so. The agency blindsided us. I'd like to believe that that day's wandering away from customary procedure was neither deliberate nor sinister, but rather systemic. Those in charge just never thought about us, the taxpaying, skeptical public. But as we've learned in other contexts, systemic ills, no matter how inadvertent, demand correction. No, the law did not require a public hearing, but democratic due process did dictate the agency provide the public an opportunity to speak. Your Lansing legislator, Mike Sigler, put it best. Listen, the residents are mad, he said. Sigler relaying neighborhood frustration concerning the project's unkempt appearance and the developer's protracted foot dragging. Thanks, Mike, for standing up for us. I wish all board members and staff had done so. But instead, at least one member sought to excuse the developer despite his broken promises. Yes, the agency has problems. Others, too, remain angry, like me and my colleagues on the Enfield Town Board, who last year found little support when we sought from the agency greater compensation for a new solar farm in Enfield. The city of Ithaca has secured a seat on the Tompkins County Industrial Development Agency. Why can't we, the rural towns? There's little I can do tonight to affect that now extended Library Place pilot, but I can do this. Tonight, I propose your legislature revisit Resolution 9855 of February 2021, withdrawn in committee a year ago, and request New York State expand the Tompkins County Industrial Development Agency Board from 7 members to 9, with the understanding that this legislature will appoint a representative from the outlying municipalities, the rural towns and villages, to fill one of those new positions, with the second seat reserved for school district representation, with all districts, city and central schools, eligible to nominate collectively that member. We need a voice. I need a voice. Most importantly, TCIDA must learn it serves every one of us, not just the biggest in rental realty. Please don't ignore our voices any longer, like some did last week. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Next, if we can move to, I'm going to ask, are there any other people that are here for public comment?
I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you. Next, I'm going to ask if there are any municipal office officials that are here to speak. Okay, there are no municipal officers. Let's move on to legislator privilege of the floor. Wow, Lee Shirtless.
I just want to thank the chairman for sending out the notice yesterday regarding our first county administrator, John Murphy, and the words that were expressed in sentiment that Joe Mariana sent as a successor to John were very well received, heartfelt. I've known John since 1978 and had the pleasure of talking with him over the years in social settings and in personal sessions. And I just don't want the meeting to go by without recognizing the legacy that he left as county administrator. He was a superb public official, and we owe a lot of what Tompkins County is today to the leadership and involvement that he had through the 70s and 80s. And I did want something to be said on the record.
All right. Thank you very much, Lee. Next, Deborah and then Ann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had occasion to go to our Department of Motor Vehicles last Friday to get my driver's license renewed, and Ronnie was in the same boat. And I want to compliment our county clerk, Maureen Reynolds. As always, when I avail myself of the services of her department, I am really impressed with how efficient and pleasant they are. You know, I've lived in several states now, and I've been to some really terrible DMVs. I think we should be grateful that we don't have one of those. We have one of the best DMVs I've ever had occasion to visit. So, yay, Maureen. Thanks.
Thank you, Deborah. Ann Corman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of Martin Luther King Day yesterday, I think one of the best things that we can do to celebrate that day and honor his memory is to push for national voting reform. So I encourage my colleagues and citizens, everyone to please, well, residents, I want to say, residents to please encourage, plead with your representatives on a federal level to please pass this, encourage people in other states to encourage their representatives at the federal level to pass voting reform and protections, because I do believe that our democracy works best when everybody's voice is heard at the election, at the voting poll. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann, for bringing that up. Any other comments? Okay. Oh, Rich John.
Thanks, Shauna. I was mentioned twice in privilege of the floor, and I'd like to just speak to those issues for a few minutes, if I could. I am the chair of the Industrial Development Agency, and a speaker questioned a decision we made at our last meeting regarding the Library Place project. A request came to the IDA, and my recollection, I don't have the agenda in front of me, but that it was on a regular order of business. So it was on the agenda. It was publicly stated that, you know, in advance of the meeting that we would be talking about that. So I'm not entirely clear what the concern is that we did something inappropriate. The request was for an extension of the timetable for application of the tax abatement. And What a developer typically asks for is that the abatement apply as soon as the construction is finished and the full value of the project is realized. When a project is delayed, you can run into a situation where the first year or so of the abatement, there's no improvement completed, and the assessment department has not assigned any new value to the property. So effectively, you dramatically change the nature of the incentive that was applied. What we typically do is we amend the timetable for application of the abatement, basically to correspond to the deal we agreed to make at the beginning of the project. Library Place, as you all know, has sat for quite a while. I don't want to speak for my colleagues on the IDA, but the real concern was that we wanted assurance that the project would go forward, not that we would be changing the nature of the agreed incentive that we said we would provide. The developer was there, and also the general contractor attended and reported that the project is getting restarted, which is, I believe, really good news. You know, we don't want it half completed. We don't want half a project. We want this thing finished. They have ordered the structural steel, and it is in the process of being fabricated up in Syracuse. You do not order structural steel. It's incredibly expensive unless the project is going forward. So that, I thought, was very good news to get from the developer at that time. You know, this has been an imposition on the neighbors, and certainly for everybody who has to drive by and see a half-completed project. But it does look like it's going forward. And what the IDA did was extend the benefit that had been agreed upon originally. We didn't really do anything else. We've done this on many occasions before, so I don't see this as a particularly controversial step. But perhaps I'm missing something. And Mike, you were there. Maybe you would want to comment further on that. But that's that issue. A speaker also called on me in my capacity as a lawyer to comment on the constitutionality of the mask and vaccine requirements. And there's an easy answer to that, which is that constitutionality is whatever the Supreme Court says it is. And the court has recently ruled on some mask issues and vaccine issues. Now, we have to live with that. What I can talk to, though, is an issue. I know we get the COVID report at our meetings, and it's a good explanation of where we are at a point in time. But I always think there's perhaps 30% of the population of the county that's not vaccinated, somewhere in that range. And a certain percentage of those unvaccinated people, like the speaker, feel very strongly that we're doing something inappropriate in supporting the use of masks and encouraging people to get the vaccine. I've certainly received a lot of email with sources from the internet expressing real doubts about masks and vaccines. And I've read them. I have looked at these sites. And yet I'm not a doctor. I'm not trained in the medical profession or in public health. So I need to rely on some information sources. And if I could describe the ones that have been sent to me, I would say they're alternative sources. And then there's the mainstream. We've made decisions that impact residents of the county. We have to. We can't sit on our hands. We have to act to do the best job we can to protect the people that live here. We could be wrong. The mainstream opinions could be wrong. However, I would like to say that even though I'm not a doctor, I am a lawyer. And one of the things lawyers are trained to do is to evaluate evidence. And I'd like to speak to that a little bit, because there's a good basis for why I think all of us, but certainly me in particular, have decided the mask mandates and the vaccine mandates make a lot of sense. One is that people in authority say so, and that includes the Centers for Disease Control, but there's lots of independent bodies that look over the shoulder of the CDC. And in fact, there's a 14-member panel that on immunization practices that reviews everything that they're doing. Interestingly, there's somebody from Ithaca on that panel. These are really noted people from across the country that lead hospitals, that are experts in their field, and you got to give them some weight. Maybe they're all wrong. But I think there's hundreds of years of expertise speaking to this issue. And then you can look at the evidence of history that we have dealt with other respiratory diseases that are highly transmissible by using masks. They've been worn in hospitals for years and years, decades, and they work. Certainly they work for other diseases, and the same with vaccines. All of us practically have received vaccinations for all sorts of diseases. And it's possible that COVID is entirely different and it doesn't work here, even though it works in all those other instances. But you take it as evidence. There's evidence in the data. You know, if you really think that masks don't work and vaccines, you know, are ineffective or dangerous or whatever else, the data does not bear that out. That perhaps, you know, there's some people that react poorly to the vaccine, but most people don't. And what we're seeing in the surge right now is people who are not vaccinated are overwhelming our medical system. It's hard to square what the speaker was talking about on privilege of the floor with the data that vaccines and masks make a difference. And certainly if it's a disease transmitted by breathing on each other, you don't have to be a medical professional to say anything that interferes with that, say social distancing, masking, will help. So I find that really powerful evidence. And finally, I think there's a plausibility issue here, that you look at the evidence and you say, does it make sense? And I've looked at these alternative sites that people rely on to say we shouldn't wear masks and we shouldn't take the vaccine. It doesn't square with the data. It doesn't square with the history. And you can't really tell who the people are who are making these assertions. Some of them claim to be doctors, but they don't have the credentials of the 14-member panel that's overseeing what the CDC is determining. You would have to say they're all wrong, that this 14-member panel, the universities, the scientists, the pharmaceutical companies, the public health officials, including on the county level here, are all wrong, whether by mistake or on purpose. I don't know how that hangs together. So to the speaker, I'd say, I feel very comfortable with what the positions we've taken to say, let's do the best we can. You know, wear masks, get the vaccine, practice social distancing, be careful. And I see in the chat, do I trust pharmaceutical companies? No, not necessarily. However, you've got all sorts of pharmaceutical companies in competition with each other. If one of these pharmaceutical companies was foolish enough to put out a vaccine that was really harmful, they would assume a lot of liability, and their competitors would call them out in a heartbeat. That hasn't happened over 2 years, well, over the year that we've had the vaccine. So I would say in this instance, I don't see a basis to distrust the pharmaceutical companies. Anyway, I'll stop talking, but I apologize for going on at some length, but I find it very frustrating that we get continually questioned on why in the world we would do this. There's really good reasons why we've supported our public health officials. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Henry Granison.
Yes, I just have a quick plug. I noticed today that the nation was going to give out free COVID tests at covidtests.gov. But I actually went to the site today and I requested full COVID tests to be sent to me. You can do it tomorrow. You can do it today. You can get four free COVID tests sent to you. Now it's going to take a week or two to get to you. But again, the Biden administration has made these tests available. And so I would encourage everybody to get their four free COVID tests at, again, covidtests.gov. Thank you.
Thank you, Henry. I saw Annie's post on Facebook and ended up signing up for my four. Fortunately, my son's going to be left out. Let's see here. Any other comments from legislators? Hey, I just want to make sure we have everyone. Okay. Thank you all. Let's move on to the chair's report and chair's appointments. I would first like to start off by congratulating Angela Sullivan at the Alcohol and Drug Council for their groundbreaking today. Their new facility off of Trip Hammer Road will offer 24/7 open access with detox treatment options and will be open to our it obviously is not open now since they are just starting the many, many renovations, but that will definitely be an added bonus that we need here in our community to take care of people that are struggling with. Next, thank you, Lee Shirtlett, for bringing forth the information in regards to John Murphy's passing. This weekend, our past county administrator, Joe Mariani, sent us information for the county's first administrator, John Murphy. John was 99 years old, and I just wanted to read a short excerpt from Joe's email because it really provides us with a clear picture of who John was. John helped usher in profound changes in the structure of Tompkins County government that followed the passage of the county's first charter in 1968. The decision to become a charter county represented a major sea change for county governance, allowing much greater latitude in how it structured and organized governmental operations. A central element of the charter was a new position of Commissioner of Budget and Administration that assumed many of the budgetary and management responsibilities formerly held by the Board of Supervisors and the elected county treasurer. Selecting the right person to fill that job was hugely important. In October 1969, National Cash Register Executive John Murphy was appointed as the county's first and, as it turns out, last Commissioner of Budget and Administration. That position was soon superseded by a 1973 charter amendment that created the new position of county administrator, essentially the county's chief executive officer, with a broad range of powers that allowed the board to initiate policies and a professional manager to administer them. Once again, the Board of Supervisors looked to John. By unanimous vote, he was appointed by the Board of Supervisors as the county's first administrator in 1973. He served in that role until his retirement in 1985. With support and guidance from the Board of Supervisors, John was instrumental in the creation of the modern county we know today, enabling Tompkins to deliver a growing range of largely mandated services effectively and efficiently. Among many of John's other achievements, his tenure included the creation of the county's Office of the Aging, COFA, and the Youth Bureau, the construction of a new county hospital, the largest construction project to that point in the county's history, and its transfer to the new nonprofit Cayuga Medical Center. the transfer of many court functions from the county to New York State, and a host of management systems and practices that remain a part of the contemporary county. Upon his retirement in 1985, John was succeeded by Scott Heyman. John was a remarkable leader and skilled manager, and until just a few months ago, he was a regular and active participant at a quarterly lunch with some of his successors and former colleagues. He will be missed even as his achievements live on. So thank you very much, Joe, who was also a past county administrator, for writing that beautiful note and acknowledging the passing of Mr. John Murphy. Thank you as well, Lee, for mentioning that. Next, I would like to address the legislature. Fellow legislators, I am honored to address this elected body, the dedicated public servants that make up our county staff, and all of our fellow county residents with this year's State of the County address. Tompkins County continues to be excellent in its service to residents, creative in problem-solving and addressing the challenges facing our community, and fortunate to have the people dedicated to work of our local government. While I'm confident that we have the people and actions in place to serve residents and address challenges, there is much work to be done to increase our resiliency and to sustain the efforts that have led our county to where it is today. The service that our county provides to residents is unparalleled. Look no further than the operations of our health department and the nurses who have personally impacted tens of thousands of lives by helping people through COVID-19. Our nurses and COVID responders have been there for people in all circumstances, whether they were sick, caring for a loved one, or afraid of how the pandemic or disease might impact them. And through every shift in guidance from the state or federal government, our staff has been there to provide clear interpretations and inform the public of not only what is changing, but why it is changing. This type of commitment to serving our community is inspiring, and I see clearly why Tompkins County has been a leader in responding to the pandemic. At the legislature level, we have supported an increased access to free testing for all county residents. Our vaccination rates are among the highest in the state, and we've been able to support keeping our community's hospital open and operational. The county's COVID response has also strengthened community partnerships with our colleagues in higher education, nonprofits, and intermunicipal partners. The level of service I described in our COVID response happens each and every day across our organization. Our county services help people find jobs, manage over 300 miles of county roads, respond to emergencies, keep the community healthy, safe, and vibrant, manage records and technology important to people's lives, deliver critical programs to people in need, oversee local elections. The list goes on, and our responsibility to keep these services running and supported has never been greater. This is something that we should all be proud of. Tompkins County has a reputation and history of progress and creativity. We're not ones to shy away from a sticky challenge. In fact, we usually dive in head first. This legislature commits frequently to gaining a deep understanding of issues facing our community and entrusts our departments and staff with finding and implementing thoughtful, creative, and oftentimes collaborative solutions that can many times involve hours and hours of great debate. Welcome aboard to the five new legislators. A highlight of Tompkins County's ability to creatively address challenges facing our community is our reimagining public safety work. Our reimagining commitments passed by the legislature in early 2021 chart a course for a more inclusive and responsive public safety system, and our process is committed to centering the experience of Black and Brown members of our community. There are nearly 20 plans under reimagining, everything from better and more consistent collection, analysis, and presentation of data to more equitable ways to recruit, retain, train, and support our law enforcement officers. I am particularly excited about the plans to implement an alternative response system for crisis intervention and wraparound health and human services delivery. We have incredible people in our workforce and community who offer direct services to those experiencing crisis and in pain. With this plan, we'll be able to study approaches in other communities and best practices to build on what we do well and invest in new approaches. As previous chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, I know firsthand the critical need for mental health and wraparound services in our county and see this plan as central to our success. I'd like to specifically offer a shout out to Tompkins County Sheriff Derek Osborne and his office for their work towards implementing a pilot program to respond to non-emergency calls in new ways. This pilot will open the doors for a better understanding of how we can respond differently when a law enforcement officer is not needed on scene. Freeing up officer time to respond in emergency situations and further reducing disproportionate minority contact with the criminal justice system. These creative solutions approved by our legislature are being diligently implemented by our county staff. I recognize that reimagining public safety can be a divisive and sometimes political issue, but I believe strongly in the plans we pass and the positive impact they will have on our community. Each month this year, we will receive an update on progress made under reimagining from our new Community Justice Center project director. And I look forward to this legislature staying engaged and continuing this work throughout our terms. The opportunity for the most creative energy from Tompkins County is how we move forward coming out of this pandemic. Our response to COVID-19 has been stellar. Having engaged staff and volunteers from nearly every department and community partners, and having leveraged resources made available through our legislative actions. Moving forward, we have the opportunity to evaluate our activities over the past 2 years and adapt to be more responsive, connected, and agile local government. Just as we put a concerted effort toward responding to the pandemic and addressing reimagining public safety, we can make strides based on what we've learned during this national and local tragedy. Our recovery fund will invest directly in the needs of local communities and organizations. In the upcoming months, the legislature will focus their attention to the applications and decide how to spend the recovery money in our community. I challenge legislators to be active and engaged listeners and partners in the work ahead, and our staff to seek the training and resources to carry out the work with excellence. The state of our county stands to be forever improved by what we do coming out of this worst of the pandemic. None of the work I've mentioned so far would be possible without our employees. The Tompkins County workforce is made up of over 700 dedicated public servants across nearly 30 departments. To best honor and support our employees, it is incumbent upon the legislature to continue to invest in them and support a continually more diverse and inclusive workplace. In 2021, we completed successful contract negotiations with Road Patrol and white-collar bargaining units, bringing us up to date with 3 of 4 bargaining units. These new contracts are responsive to our labor needs and our labor unions and reflect an ongoing commitment to our workforce. This year, we will undertake a compensation study to better understand the investment we currently make in our workforce and what adjustments must be made to further invest in our employees and the future operations of this organization. We want to continue recruiting, retaining, and supporting a diverse and excellent workforce that can continue to render excellent service to our community. Our work in the areas of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion has become a cross-organizational effort with engagement from employees and legislators across different backgrounds and departments. This work being carried out by our Chief Equity and Diversity Officer continues to strengthen our organization, and I look forward to the efforts in 2022 to improve our organization in these areas. In 2021, we adopted organizational values and updated our diversity statement to further provide a vision for this organization and our people. Our values of integrity, accountability, equity, and respect are guideposts that direct our work and reflect the input and ideas of our workforce. These mutually agreed upon values will be further rolled out in 2022 in conjunction with the updated diversity statement. Our Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Group will continue to provide guidance on a monthly basis. They will continue to collaborate with the Employee-Based Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, or the JEDI Committee. Each month in our Budget, Capital, and Personnel meeting, we will have a report from WDIC and listen to their recommendations and ideas. While we celebrate our achievements and investments, we must continue to acknowledge the work to be done to increase resiliency and sustain the efforts that have led us to where we are today. Each year, our county budget is an opportunity to address critical needs, sustain our efforts and operations, and increase our resiliency. Our 2022 county budget is an expression of our values, and it reinvests in our workforce and sponsored agency while holding the tax levy constant. As we think about and develop our 2023 budget, we must continue to listen to our community's needs. Through the capital program, we accelerated our goals for achieving net zero emissions from county facilities to 2027, invested in greening the county's fleet vehicles, and invested in needed infrastructure improvements. Environmental sustainability and conservation continue to be priorities for our county, and we are making strides toward lowering emissions and influencing change throughout our community. We have a responsive legislature with a tradition of investing in what matters to our organization and to our residents. I am looking forward to a successful year in 2022 and becoming more resilient and investing in sustainability and betterment across our operations. In closing, local government feels closer to people's lives than ever before. The successes and challenges I noted in this address have deep and lasting impacts on the lives of our constituents and neighbors. It is my sincere hope that we as a legislature continue to make the investments to reflect our roles in people's lives and take the responsibility seriously. Thank you. Okay, now the moment everyone has been waiting for, committee assignments. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what we've done with the committees. We have switched a few things around. We are no longer going to have the Housing and Economic Development Committee. We will be moving the housing discussion into Health and Human Services and Economic Development into what we will call PDEC. We had that a few years ago, and we're actually going to go back to that. There are a few other changes as well. I would ask that all of the legislators take a look in their red folders, and you will see a committee list with assignments as well as the different topics in each committee. So just to go over a few of the changes, we will be adding the Community Recovery Program grants to Budget, Capital, and Personnel. We are moving the Center for History and Culture from GO into Facilities and Infrastructure. We will also not have the Downtown Facilities Committee, and we'll be moving that into Facilities and Infrastructure. The Green Fleet and Facilities will be moved into Facilities and Infrastructure from PEAK. And then MEGA, Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance, will be moved to Facilities and Infrastructure from GO. Metropolitan Planning Organization, Ithaca Tompkins County Transportation Council, that is actually going to be moved to Facilities and Infrastructure. That's coming from HED. And also TCAC will be moved to Facilities and Infrastructure. Looking to the next page, Health and Human Services will again receive housing issues, including and beyond continuum of care. That's coming from HED. Planning, Development, and Economic Quality, that is PDEC. That is going to combine departments and programs from HED and PEAK. We will also be moving Recycling and Materials Management from F&I to the PDEC committee. And then we will be adding public safety, reimagining public safety and CJC to that list. Also, as far as the Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations, what we called a committee before, we will have this as an active group that will meet on a quarterly basis. Deborah Dawson will chair that meeting, and we will be inviting our representatives as well as agencies such as NYSAC and NACO to attend our meetings so that we can figure out ways to lobby to our local representatives and ask them questions that we might need in order for us to operate local government. So I will name the committee and then name the chair and vice chair and people on the committee. Starting off with the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Chair Deborah Dawson, Vice Chair Lee Shurtleff, Rich John, Mike Lane, and Greg Mezzi. Next, Facilities and Infrastructure, Chair Mike Lane, Vice Chair Randy Brown, Ann Corman, Amanda Champion, and Lee Shurtleff. Government Operations, Chair Amanda Champion, Vice Chair Greg Mezzi, Dan Klein, Mike Lane, and Travis Brooks. Health and Human Services Committee, Chair Dan Klein, Vice Chair Veronica Piller, Randy Brown, Mike Sigler, and Travis Brooks. Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality, Chair Ann Corman, Vice Chair Greg Mezzi, Deborah Dawson, Henry Granison, Randy Brown. Public Safety, Chair Rich John, Vice Chair Travis Brooks, Veronica Piller, Henry Granison, and Mike Sigler. There are also some chair's appointments that I would like to take effect immediately. Ithaca Area Development, IAED Board of Directors, Shauna Black and Ann Corman. IAED Executive Committee, Lisa Holmes. Chamber of Commerce, Mike Sigler, Shauna Black alternate. Extension Service, yes.
You're leaning in a little, cutting out.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you.
We'll redo Chamber of Commerce. Mike Sigler and Shauna Black alternate. Extension Services, CCE, Dan Klein and Randy Brown. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Henry Granison, Chair. Ethics Advisory Board, Rich John, Chair. Ithaca Metropolitan Planning Organization, ITC-TC Policy Committee, Michael Lane and Randy Brown as the alternate. Tompkins Center for History and Culture, Governance Committee, Rich John, non-voting representative. Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance, this term is ongoing until resignation received or removed by the chair of the legislature, Terry Carroll, appointed 12-21-21. Cugo Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization, Darby Kiley and Ann Corman will be the alternate. Special Negotiating Committee, to conduct collective negotiation with employee organizations. Corrections Union, Rich John, Travis Brooks. Road Patrol, Civil Division, Mike Sigler, Mike Lane. CSEA, Blue Collar, Randy Brown, Dan Klein. CSEA, White Collar, Greg Mezzi, Lee Shurtleff. Tompkins Cortland Community College, Negotiations, Faculty, Mike Lane. PAA, Rich John. Adjunct, Deborah Dawson, CSEA, Ann Corman. And those are this year's assignments. I also want to make sure that during our break that we are able to work on scheduling these committees as soon as possible. We are trying to work through everyone's schedules, and if we could look in your red folder, there's a calendar of existing committees and their times. Ideally, it would be great if some of these committees could stay in the same time. However, we understand that there needs to be some flexibility. And I would ask the committee chairs to lead this process and reach out to your committee members. Okay. We do not have any special topical presentations and or discussions this evening. However, we do have reports by our county administrator. Hi, Lisa Holmes.
My report tonight is rather brief, and then we'll launch right into the COVID update. I would just bring to folks' attention that today Governor Hochul released her executive budget plan, and I will be, you know, looking into it further on the impacts of the county and asking department heads to keep us informed of what they're hearing through their state associations as the New York State budget process moves forward. But other than that, I'd like to move right into Amy Hendricks and Frank Krupa and Dominic providing us with the latest COVID update.
All right, we'll get started in just a moment. Frank is running the slideshow tonight, so I'll let him bring that up for all of you, and we'll talk a little bit about what has happened January 4th through January 18th. Frank, you can go ahead to the next slide. So the subject for this is there has been a lot of changes. Contact tracing operations have been suspended since we last met. And there's a lot more information that we'll go into in later slides. As far as disease incidents, currently there are 12 hospitalizations. We are up, unfortunately, 2 deaths since the last time. So we have now hit 50 deaths here in Tompkins County. Our active cases are at 503. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the shifting around the information that we have, because as things like positive self-tests and other reports are coming in, it's making it a little more difficult and it's a little less easy for us to track some of it. Another piece is our order announcements. Frank, you're killing me, buddy. I don't have great connectivity here, so Frank's running it from Dryden. Apparently they have a little bit better signal out there than in Ulysses tonight. So orders and announcements. This is a lot of changes in the last week, or 2 weeks, a lot about updated the isolation and quarantine guidance. They updated self-attestation forms at New York State. The disaster emergency in New York State continues, with the terms and conditions, and suspensions going on until February 15th, 2022. And you'll see Law Chapter 1, January 15th, remote meetings extended as long as the pandemic is going. So currently the executive order goes through February 15th. That means remote meetings would be extended until then. As long as that executive order continues to get extended, then remote meetings will be extended. I know that has been something for discussion here. As far as local operations, the 3 higher ed institutions announced how they're bringing students back to campus. We've talked about self-testing. I know that the federal self-testing program, you also mentioned in your legislature updates, that's up and running. So a lot more tests are coming into the community. We do plan on getting additional self-tests and are preparing for that when and if they come. It's not clear when we'll receive those, although some of our congregate care facilities have received those tests, so they're not going through the county. They're getting them directly. Lots of communications continuing, things like letting people know about this updated guidance, also talking about booster eligibility, testing hours, self-testing. A big piece of our communications is continuing to communicate with our community what's going on with the disease and why there still is importance in following COVID. what that means and how it's different than others. So a lot of this continues on, and we'll go to the next slide, Frank. All right. This just shows the continued expenses over time with COVID hours. So you can see employee hours continue. We're still having a response. Our non-employee expenses largely is our testing program and working in partnership with the hospital to provide that. Total employee expenses shows some combined expenses, and then our FEMA reimbursement. We continue to submit reimbursement, and it goes through the process. There's always a lag in between submittal, and even from payment to submittal, there's a lag there. So this provides just a little bit oversight and how our expenses are working. Next slide, Frank. And that's where I'm going to turn it over to you to talk a little bit about what has shifted in the COVID landscape.
Great. Thanks, Amy. It's been mentioned a couple of times. One of the big changes that's occurred over the last few days is our shift away from contact tracing and moving case investigations to the state, and really moving towards a more self-responsibility model. Our priorities will be shifting to education and outreach, vaccinations, working with our high-risk populations as we stand down the contact tracing. I mean, it is important to say again, contact tracing is effective in many instances, and it's been effective throughout this pandemic. But with the severity of illness, what it is, with the infectious nature and period of the Omicron variant and the reduction of isolation and quarantine times, its effectiveness has been lowered as a tool. So we're shifting our resources to interventions that we think we can continue that are practical and will hopefully limit spread as we navigate through this Omicron peak. So we will be standing on contact tracing for most populations. We're still working with some smaller groups just to make sure that we can transition that all successfully. There is new guidance on our website, as well as links to the state isolation and quarantine self-attestation order for individuals that might need that documentation for their employment or school or other third parties. Pre-K through 12 has been a lot of conversation about that. We will be standing down contact tracing for them as well, and there is no expectation that the schools will continue it. They will, of course, still exclude children that are symptomatic and or test positive, and they will be doing different levels of communication out to their populations when cases are identified. There was FAQs that were put out by the state, and we have those on our website as well. And I mentioned the self-affirmation forms. Booster dose clinics continue. We had another successful one this past Saturday with 400 Moderna and 300 Pfizer booster doses administered. That brings our total over the last three weekends, one in December and the past two weekends, to nearly 3,000 booster doses administered. So we're hopeful that we are making a dent in the backlog, and that appointments will become more readily available in the community. We have a clinic that's open right now for registration for this Saturday for Moderna. We're gauging that to see what uptake is, and we'll likely be also offering Pfizer this Saturday as well. We just want to make sure that if the demand for Moderna is there, that we are able to meet it. We're still waiting a data on the boosted population. I've said before, we need that to come from the state, because the volume that we're doing really wouldn't be representative of the total boosted population. So our numbers alone don't really paint the picture. And as we've said before and have said many times, boosters continue to prove safe and effective in preventing severe illness and death from COVID, as vaccines have throughout, and we'll share some data on that in a moment. Self-test guidance. There's a lot of talk about self-tests. The federal program launched, as Amy said. We have information about self-tests on our website, Our PIO group created the sticker that will go on any test that the state that we receive at the county for distribution. And we do have an online reporting form for folks that do test positive with a self-test. And that still auto-generates some information for them about what to do for themselves around isolation and quarantine and what they might need to do for documentation for third parties like work and school. So jumping into the data, hospitalization data still shows the same story. For those under 70 years of age, vaccination status has a significant impact on the need for hospitalization. So, again, we still encourage folks to get vaccinated and boosted. And our resident deaths information, really January is the change. I'm now seeing that we've had 3 deaths in January, 2 of which were not vaccinated, 1 of which was. So, again, the message is please get boosted. Please get vaccinated if you have not yet done that. And we still are asking that masks be worn indoors and that folks stay home whenever they might be ill. And that's all we have for tonight.
Thank you very much, Amy and Frank. Are there any questions? Randy Brown.
Thank you very much. I don't see much information, or maybe it's not available, on what people should do for treatments or therapeutics. I know isolation is time has changed. Even the pills they talk about that they come out to help people once they first get COVID. What is the county hearing about that, and what are your thoughts?
So for most people, over-the-counter medications will be sufficient to help them navigate the symptoms that they might encounter. For those that become more ill, it's really important that they seek out the care of their healthcare provider. They're going to know the most about their overall health and be able to help guide them to what options are available. If the specific question is around antiviral therapeutic medications, we're still waiting for those to make their way to the market. Have not heard a lot of information recently about where that stands in the process, but those will be a big tool in the toolkit, as we say, to help move forward with dealing with COVID. If we have an antiviral medication that can reduce symptoms in people that do become positive, that will be significant, probably second to only vaccines, which are preventative in nature. That will be the biggest thing that we'll have to be able to move forward with COVID once they're readily available.
Thank you. Henry Granison.
Yes, thank you for your report, Frank. I noticed that Cornell has moved to a moved away from cloth mask, and I wondered what your position was regarding that.
Yeah, so the mask conversation has been a big one, certainly in the last couple of weeks, and there's been a lot of conversation about KN95s, and this isn't a uncomplicated issue. So I'll start with KN95s or N95s. If you read the information that comes with those, first, they're single use, and so folks should be aware of that they're not intended to be washed. And they're not intended to be worn for long periods of time. So it does require a supply in order to maintain using them. Second, if you're using them on label, they require fit testing, which is a process which determines if the mask is an appropriate fit for the wearer, and that it will therefore provide the protection that the box that the labeling includes. So those two things aside, yes, a KN95 or an N95 mask, even if not fit tested, most likely will provide more protection from COVID, right? I think that we know that that's pretty straightforward. The question then becomes, what do we do, right? It's probably not possible or practical that we're going to provide a regular supply of KN95 masks to everyone in our community. And so really where we've been focusing the attention of our communities for those that don't have resources or means to obtain KN95s is there are other ways to improve mask wearing. And the CDC has good information around that. We're really looking for a tight fit Something that includes, you know, looping around the ears so it holds the mask tight to your face, has a nose clip to create air, eliminate air gaps at the top, has multiple layers of fabric but still is breathable. So there are ways to improve mask wearing. And I want to make sure that while we start talking about KN95s, we can't provide them to everyone, so we're trying to provide alternatives and instructions for people that might not have access to them. So, yes, KN95s, if worn and fit tested, provide a superior level of protection than something that's not fit tested or is not, you know, manufactured for that particular filtration purpose.
Another question. I noticed there was one county in New York State that stopped reporting daily.
And you Henry, we can't hear you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, there was one county that stopped doing daily reports.
We can't hear you.
You plan on not doing daily reports?
No, we still can't hear you.
So I heard his question. He was asking that there's a county that has stopped reporting daily numbers, and I think the question is what is our plan? We're talking about what makes sense, Henry. Some of the things that we've been reporting, particularly active case counts, is gonna become less useful because we're not going to have the information on every positive case as we have previously. So we're looking at the data. We've been saying for quite some time that case counts really aren't the measure anymore. Severity of illness, hospitalizations, deaths are really what we're paying attention to. The data slides that we showed were those measures versus case counts. So over time, our reporting will change. We want to do it in a smart way. We want to make sure we're still providing the community the information that they want and need. But we also want to make sure that whatever it is we're providing is first accurate and then useful for the community in their thinking around COVID.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank and Henry. Next, Veronica Pillar and then Ann Corman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Frank and Amy, for the update. I have a few questions, if that's okay. One about boosters. I saw you're still waiting for state booster data, but I'm wondering if you have data on the hospitalized folks here on their booster status. And more broadly, my understanding is that the vaccine's effectiveness against Omicron is really dependent on, like, the booster helps it a lot versus, like, having had the original series back in the spring, say. So should we be updating our understanding of the phrase fully vaccinated to include being boosted or ineligible for it? Or what do you say?
Yeah, so to your first question about the booster status of the hospitalizations, I'll have to go back to the data and talk with our team about what's included when we're talking about fully vaccinated. I believe it's just the initial two doses. I'm not sure that we're accounting for boosters in that data yet, but we can certainly look at that and see if that's something we can include. As far as, you know, the second question, which I think was around boosters and fully vaccinated. It's somewhat unfortunate that we use the term fully vaccinated with the initial series of the vaccine. Many of the vaccine series that we get at Children have one, two, some have three, and even more vaccines that are required to achieve the immunity that we're looking for. So, at this point, I think you're going to see an adjustment on what is considered to be, fully protected or as protected as is possible via vaccine. Having an initial series and then a follow-up vaccine is not uncommon, but to use fully vaccinated with the first series of the first two doses, unfortunately, I think kind of painted a picture that, a lot of folks are pointing to saying, what do you mean now we need a third dose or maybe even additional in the future? It really is the nature of vaccines. So to answer your question more succinctly, yes, booster doses are already becoming in some settings necessary to be considered, fully protected, particularly in those most sensitive settings like, healthcare and those dealing with seniors.
Thank you. Second question, do you have any update on the availability of boosters for homebound individuals?
Yeah, we started our homebound program Friday, this past Friday. I believe four people got vaccinated, and we're planning to do them each Friday for the next few weeks. So we're that program is underway.
Great, thank you. And last question, mainly coming from a constituent, was about the mask and or vaccine mandates for businesses. First, I wonder if you could clarify what's the current guidance since the January 15th, executive order deadline passed. Is it just the same now? And then also, I noticed that complaint form on the health department website that people can report if businesses are not enforcing the mask mandate or whichever. I'm wondering, are you able to share any results on, has that been used? What has been happening? How's that going?
Sure. So if the first question was about the mask mandate, that has been extended, I believe, until February 1st. At this point, so it still stands that any indoor setting in New York State requires masking. The second question again, I'm sorry.
Have people been using the health department's complaint form about businesses, and what, just any update around that?
Yeah, folks did, more particularly early on. We were receiving complaints. Our environmental health division is handling those. The last time that I got a report, and this was a few weeks ago, we had received just over 100 total complaints. We use an education approach where we send information when somebody gets a first complaint. If there are multiple complaints, our folks are going out to work with the businesses. And really our expectation is that the businesses have signage up and have masks available for those that might not have one when they arrive. And in most instances, that's been the case. So at least from our perspective, our businesses have been doing what we've asked of them.
Thank you.
Great question. Thank you, Veronica. Next, Ann Foreman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, thanks for the update, Frank and Amy. I just also wanted to let you know that this afternoon I helped pass out masks that were from the state to the county, to the municipalities, through the Trumansburg Village, and then onto Juniper Manor 1 and 2. So they are getting out there to populations in need, and so it felt really good to follow that path. So now every resident at the low-income senior centers in Trumansburg, Juniper 1 and 2, have masks. And we also happened to coincide with the time where I was getting some reusable bags from the recycling center for those folks. So we put them, they got a reusable bag too. So, and the response from the people we saw was very happy, because they don't get out a lot. And when they do, they're not always thinking about going to get masks. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Anne. Any other questions for Amy and Frank? Okay, I see no other hands. Thank you both. Next is our county attorney, Bill Troy.
I do have a brief report to share with you. we've begun the process of interviewing candidates for the deputy county attorney position, and I'm hopeful that we should be able to name a deputy by next week, and that will be good to get somebody else on board. Other than that, I have work coming in. I'm working on responses of people who have questions, and it's going well from what I can see.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions for Bill Troy, county attorney? Okay, I see none. Thank you very much. Director of Finance, Rick Snyder. Hi, Rick.
I have no formal report tonight. We were hoping to have sales tax information for you for December. We just got those receipts in on late Friday, so we haven't had time to distribute them to the municipalities or do the reconciliations yet. And being that it is the last month of the year, it takes a bit longer to do the final quarterly report and bring a year-end report to you. So you can look forward to that at your next legislative meeting for sales tax. The same is true for room tax. We did get a report submitted from Lisa Schott in the Treasury Division and from Nick Hemholt in our Planning and Sustainability Division. But we haven't had time to reconcile the numbers and do a full audit of that. So in lieu of bringing you a room tax report, that also will come to you at the next meeting. I will share a brief screen on what we think the total amount is for the year. So I'm going to share my screen real quick with you. Here we go. You should see here on the view, this column here is the 2021 column. And what it appears like we have received in the fourth quarter for room tax is $818,639. You can see that's a little below the quarter three receipts, but it's probably the best fourth quarter we've seen in many years. So I'm highlighting that number there that shows the 818,000. So what does that total for the year? The total for the year is this figure, close to $3,009,000. So that's a healthy rebound in room tax. Again, these are unaudited figures. We will be bringing you a full report at the next meeting. And you might ask, how does that compare to our budget for room tax for 2021? That's $1.4 million more than what we budgeted. So I thought I would bring you a preview of what we think room tax is for the year 20 to 21. And that's really all I have to bring to you tonight.
Ann Foreman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering, Rick, if it's possible when you you said you're going to come with a more full report next meeting.
Next meeting.
If you could compare it to 2019.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And that's good news that we're up on that. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
Any other questions for Rick Snyder? Okay, I see none. Thank you, Rick, for attending.
Thank you, and good night.
Right. Are there any reports from other county staff? Deanna, I see that you are here with us in our meeting. Do you have a report for us this evening? I'm going to take that as...
Okay. No
report. Okay, thank you. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? I see no hands. And we will move on to our consent agenda. Resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group, unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. First off is appointments, board appointments, 10624. I have three appointments to the Tompkins County Public Library Board of Trustees. Liam G.B. Murphy, member, term expires December 31st, 2024. Ingrid Jensen, member, term expires December 31st, 2024. Nina Miller, member, term expires December 31st, 2024. Health and Human Services, Resolution A, Budget Adjustment, COVID-19 ELC School Grant, Health Department, ID 641. Resolution B, Budget Adjustment, New York State Public Health Corps Fellowship Program, Public Health 4010, ID 10639. Resolution C, designating the Community Development Block Grant Environmental Certifying Officer, Environmental Health, ID 10629. Government Operations. Appointment of temporary Board of Assessment Review members to serve on administrative review panels, ID 10566. Can I have someone move our consent agenda? Moved by Greg Mezzi, seconded by Deborah Dawson. And we will do a roll call.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
Yes.
Lee Shirtless?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
P9, 0 no's.
Okay, thank you all. We are moving to the standing and special committees. And first up is Rich John with our Public Safety Committee.
Thank you, Shauna. The Public Safety Committee will be meeting this Thursday at 3 o'clock. We have a fairly straightforward agenda. One of the things I anticipate we will do is review what we did in 2021 and our early goals. It was certainly an odd year because of the pandemic and some of the financial issues that we've addressed or are addressing, but we will meet and discuss those. I would also note our jail population is at 35 with 5 board outs.
Thank you very much, Rich. Any questions for Rich John? Deborah Dawson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Rich. I was curious to know how we're going to be monitoring the progress of our Reimagining Public Safety. Will the CJC folks be reporting to us periodically through your committee?
That's a good question. We're right in the thick of trying to determine that. I'm sitting with a group of people that are meeting once a week to launch an advisory board that will work with the director of the CJC. We met this morning and we talked about that issue among many others of what the structure is going to be. We anticipate finishing our work by March, and so I should be able to give you a better answer by then, but we're still going around and around.
Thank you, Rich. Any other questions for Rich John, Chair of Public Safety? Okay, I see none. Thank you, Rich. Next up, Health and Human Services. And we do have a resolution. If I can actually have someone move the resolution for us. Ann Corman, would you like to read it for us? Thank you.
Sure. This is Resolution E, appropriation from contingent fund and contract with Human Services Coalition for continued 211 COVID-19 response. And this was adopted by the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee.
Thank you, Anne. And can I have a seconder, please? Seconded by Amanda. And I am happy to explain this. We have increased 211 does our response, and we have seen an increase in costs. So this is to add funding to that budget line so that they get paid more for their increase of service. Are there any questions on this resolution? Anne?
It's not a question, but I just want to comment that I've heard from the public and that it's really valuable to have the 211 services. We keep asking them to do more things, especially because of the pandemic. So I wanted to shout out to thank you for the staff at 211 and the Human Services Coalition for organizing that.
Thank you, Anne. And any other questions on this resolution? Okay, I see none. Let's do a roll call.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
Yes.
Lee Shirtless? Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you.
And Health and Human Services met January 12th, and we went over our goals. I am happy to, after 4 years, pass this committee over to Dan Klein. I know that he will take very good care of the committee and its members and the good work that they do. So congratulations, Dan. You have received the best committee of the legislature. Those are fighting words. Okay. Next up, we have Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. Chair Michael Lane.
Yes, the best committee of the legislature. We'll meet again on this Thursday at 9 a.m. I want to welcome Amanda Champion, who will be coming on to the committee. I'm going to say we'll miss Dan Klein, who's been a member of the F&I for several years and has always been a great member. Certainly welcome Lee and Randy, who are going to join the committee as well. We don't have a heavy business agenda coming up on Thursday, but we will spend some time with our future goals for the committee. And I think that's important, particularly since Chair Black has assigned some new departments to us to oversee. And I think we're going to need to spend some time looking at things like TCAT, looking at things like MEGA and the Green Fleet facilities a little more deeply than we have in the past. Sorry to be losing recycling and materials management, but I know they'll find a great home over in the planning committee. So those are some of the things that we'll be talking about on Thursday, and we'll report more after that.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions for Mike Lane? Also, I want to remind legislators that your new assignments begin February 1st. However, it might be helpful to sit in some of these meetings that are currently, we still have two more weeks of January, or a week and a half. Some of these meetings that are yet to happen, because these are the topics that we will be addressing in 2022. Next up is Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee. Mike Sigler, Vice Chair.
I have no report.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. The actual best committee. Mm-hmm. We met on January 6th, a couple weeks ago, and had some good conversations about a couple different things. We had a conversation about the committees, legislative committees, which was in part to help inform our chair and vice chair of folks' ideas and get some new ideas out there. We also talked about cell phone reception in Tompkins County. This is a topic that Dan Klein has brought up, and Greg Potter was there, our director of IT services, and we talked about doing a physical mapping survey of residents and where cell phone reception is available and where it's not. And IT is putting together a very simple website. I don't know if it's live yet. It's not live yet. But we'll be asking you all to share this with your constituents, and it'll just be a very short little survey that they can fill out. What's your address? Do you have cell service there? And this will help, you know, give us an idea of what is actually out there and what is not. So stay tuned for more on that. We also had an opportunity to try out one of the rules of the legislature. A couple years ago, we revised our conference and travel training fund process. Travis Brooks has a conference that he wants to go to that's outside the normal NYSAC conferences that we all know about. So our process is, if you have a conference you'd like to attend, come to GEO, tell us a little bit about it, how much is it going to cost, And the idea is to give folks a sort of public forum to let the public know, you know, what kind of conferences you're thinking about attending. It's sort of for approval. It's a little hard for us to approve what each other wants to do, but it is, you know, we want to make sure folks aren't going far afield of the work that we do for the county. So that was a great opportunity to test out that process. We will meet again the first Thursday in February, whatever that date is, welcoming some new members. And I think that's it.
Any questions for Amanda? Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, thanks, Shauna. I would just comment that we have our policy on funds for legislator training. And I would recommend that in the first year of the new legislators that we expand the amount available to the new legislators so that they can all attend NYSEC if they so choose, even if they're going to attend some other training. It's a steep learning curve on the legislature. I believe NYSEC is very helpful in doing that, and I'd hate to have a new legislator decide that they're going to forego NYSEC because there's some other opportunity. I'd also note that NYSEC gives a free pass for first-year legislators so that it's already cheaper for them to attend. So really the cost that we're talking about is the travel and the room. So I offer that. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Rich, did you want to make a motion for that?
I'd be happy to. I would move that.
Oh, so Amanda had questions.
Well, I think we were going to talk about it again at the next GO, and probably that would be the best place to make a motion. Rich did bring this up briefly.
Great.
And we thought, yeah, if somebody wants to go to another conference, but they also want to go to NYSEC, we should make sure that that's possible.
Okay.
My one question is the timing. Does it work if you wait until the next GO? Is it too late to register for NYSEC at that point?
I think we get an early bird.
I believe so. The conference isn't until March, so I'm not sure when the deadline is for signing up for that.
Okay.
Okay, I have Deborah and then Annie, and then I'll pop them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I totally agree with Rich. And if that was a motion, I would have been happy to second it. I think in order to accommodate the possibility that the early bird registration would predate the time frame for having it go through GO and then the next ledge meeting, after that, we might want to consider the possibility of a special GO meeting just to entertain that issue if necessary. Would you be willing? Okay, great.
And we might not need the early bird considering that it's free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then it's free.
So, but I agree with Rich. I watched the meeting and I think that's a very, very good idea. I attended the NYSEC my first few months, serving, and the seminars were absolutely incredible and very, very helpful for getting started. Ann Corman?
Thanks. I was going to say something similar just because with the early bird pricing, I don't know if the meals, which nobody had mentioned yet, the meals are quite costly, the meal package. So if we can figure out some way to help people to know and register early, I think that might be helpful for people because otherwise we have them wait and then the cost is inflated.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we'll get started on that relatively soon. Amanda?
Yeah, I mean, I looked up the conference. It's not even posted on their website yet. Yeah. So it's still last year's conference. So I think there's time.
Katrina said that it's at the bottom of the website. So we have time, but we'll start working on that. I also wanted to bring up and just make sure that we go by the process that we have set forth in the past in regards to actions that this legislature takes I know that there was a conversation about the cell phone mapping, and typically this goes through committee and we do some type of resolution or some type of vote, and we make sure that the full legislature is in agreement with an action that we take. So Amanda, as chair, I don't know if you would like to do a straw poll. We could certainly go forward on an action by doing a straw poll, just to get a sense of if this legislature is supportive of the idea of moving forward with the website.
Well, I think we kind of felt like the committee made that decision. It wasn't something that was going to take the department that much time. I mean, I think a lot of times committees make decisions like that to move forward with something. I'm not sure that without hearing in full detail the discussion that folks would know what they were voting on.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I just want to make sure that whenever we have decisions that 14 of us are included in them. As far as the actual process, if you could send us information on the proposal and what's being done, I think it would be important for all of us to know.
Okay. I guess I would recommend that folks watch the meeting. There wasn't really any written documentation. Again, like, it wasn't going to take the IT department that much time to do, and it was just sort of a beginning step to, like, see what happens.
Okay.
But I'm sure we could come up with something to send out.
Yeah, I'm sure that all 14 legislators are aware of a new initiative. I understand that there wasn't a lot of staff time, and the staff were interested, but it would be great for all of us to know about it. Thank you. Okay, any other questions for Amanda? Rich Gunn?
Yeah, just a clarification from the GO meeting. The discussion about the survey on the website, I made the statement, my understanding is that the county has not taken any position on whether we are in any way responsible for telephone service in the rural areas of the county. And given the potential expense to remedy any kind of situation, I'd be reluctant for us to backdoor our way in there. And I think that was a sense of the committee, that it was not proposing that we would be responsible, just collecting some information. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Okay, thank you. Oh, Deborah?
Yeah, thank you. Further to Rich's point, I think if the county were to follow up on this, and I'm not saying that we would, that would not be an initiative that we would pursue through GO. It would be much more likely to go through PDEC.
Okay, thank you. No other questions? Okay, moving on, Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Ann Foreman, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have not met since our last meeting, since our last legislative meeting, but we do have a meeting coming up this coming Monday, January 24th at 1:30, and we're welcoming in a new member, Randy Brown, Legislator Randy Brown. And a couple of things I want to point out on our agenda is that we are going to have a presentation from Irene Weiser on the New York State environmental bills that are in the queue, and that would be of most interest to the county to track or could affect the county this year. So she's going to talk about those, give us a primer on that. And we have in the agenda packet, which we'll be discussing, from the CASE annual report, that's the climate and sustainable energy advisory board. So they will look at that. And this will be our last meeting of PEAK. And I wanted to thank the members and Vice Chair Deborah Dawson and members Legislator Daniel Klein and Amanda Champion for joining us on this. And we'll be morphing into a different committee, which you've already talked about, PDEC, and we'll be welcoming some other members and with Legislator Greg Mezzi as vice chair. So thank you. And just one, as someone said, already I want to reiterate that. So if you're going to be on PDEC next year or next month, if you could please try and come to this meeting, or you can watch it on YouTube by the magic of the recordings on here. So that's great. But if you could tune in when you get the link, we'd be glad to have you, and you could, we welcome you any questions or comments you have at that meeting. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Annie. And next we have budget cap, or I'm sorry, are there any questions for Ann Corman? Okay, I see none. Thanks, Annie. Next is Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Deb Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did meet last week, and I guess the major thing we discussed was a review of all of our plans and goals through 2021 that we never really got to because it was kind of a busy year. The committee did do quite a lot, but it just wasn't the stuff that we anticipated we would be doing. So that's what happens. Life's what happens when you're making other plans. I have one resolution. Resolution F, adoption of a local law number blank of 2022, a local law increasing the compensation of the Tompkins County Sheriff, ID 10599, and I would move that.
Can I have a seconder, please? Seconded by Amanda Champion. And Deborah, would you like to explain this?
Sure would. Okay, so as it happens every 4 years, BCP initiates a process by which the legislature sets the salaries for our other electeds, the county clerk and the county sheriff, for their next elected term. This time, when the issue came up, we, of course, moved forward, and at one of our meetings last year, we did set the salaries for the clerk and the sheriff. There was kind of a special issue that arose with respect to the sheriff's salary, and that was that since his election, I guess it was in 2018, some circumstances have arisen within the pay structure of the county sheriff's office. Specifically, the undersheriff's position was reexamined and upgraded to a job grade 90, which meant that she was being paid about $10,000 more a year than the sheriff was, or is being paid about $10,000 more a year than the sheriff is. And the lieutenants in the sheriff's office under the new bargaining agreement are now also earning more than the sheriff is earning. Some of us felt that that was not a tenable set of circumstances for a law enforcement agency to operate under. I know that there's substantial disagreement about this, and I'm sure those disagreements will be aired. But I separated the issue of raising the sheriff's salary immediately from the issue of setting his salary for the next term because of those disagreements. Basically, what this particular law would do, consistent with the resolution we passed about the sheriff's next term salary, is pay him at a job grade level 91. This would create a structure for the department going forward where the sheriff was always paid more than the undersheriff. And so no future legislature would have to grapple with the issue that we are now faced with. So in substance, this resolution and the accompanying law would make that increase in the sheriff's salary to job grade level 91 effective in 45 days. And the reason that there's a 45-day lag is that when we raise an elected salary in the middle of a term, that increase is subject to the possibility of a permissive referendum. And that would take 45 days in order for people to petition and put together a request for such a referendum. One of the concerns that we had about this is that the public might not be real happy about raising the sheriff's salary midterm. And that's why we had a public hearing, which, as you may have noticed, no one seemed interested enough to show up for. So I think that covers it.
Thank you, Deborah. Any comments, questions? Greg?
Yeah, just a point of information. On the permissive referendum, would that just be as it pertains to the sheriff's 2021 salary and not
2022?
It's January. Yeah. 2022 salary, not on the go forward, which was already unanimously voted on by the legislature previous to this one.
Yeah, it's definitely within our purview to set his salary for the next term. And we have the option of adjusting it midterm, but that adjustment would be subject to permissive referendum.
Just for this remaining term. Okay, thank you.
Mike Lane.
Well, we just heard Deborah lay this out. She's been a strong proponent of doing this right along. And I understand that, and I think she's explained in the past that because the sheriff's office is sort of a military organization, it's pretty important that that the top person get paid more than the subordinates. Here's where I think that analogy fails. The top person in our sheriff's department is an elected official. You take the military, how many generals or admirals are elected by the public? None. We have never changed an elected official's salary from what it was set prior to the election before. It's a terrible precedent that's being requested here. I know that county attorney was asked to find a way to be able to do this, and he came forward not with a resolution but with a local law, which would require a permissive referendum. We're in this pandemic where we're only taking comment through the Zoom process. We get very few people anyway to come and talk to us through the Zoom. I don't think we can really judge by the fact that we didn't hear one way or the other tonight what we should be doing here. I have no problem at all with the change in the salary structure for next year. I think that's fine. I do have a problem with changing it for this year, especially since it wasn't one figure in year one of the sheriff's term that followed through for 4 years. Every year, it's tied to the raises that were negotiated with the white-collar unit in comparison. I think it was our former chair, Leslie McBean Claiborne, at our last meeting, who was questioning very carefully whether the sheriff would be receiving raises under the white-collar contract that we just went ahead and approved last year. And indeed, his salary will increase by 4%
for 2021, retroactive, and another 3% for 2022. Now, I realize that some folks are making an issue of, well, he's getting paid lower than the people that he naturally wanted to see get raises. But he went in to this with the understanding of what the salary would be for the 4 years, including the raises that would come along. And for us to now change this is, I think, not a proper way to proceed. And I certainly can't support it. I'm sorry it was brought forward. I realize that there have been some folks that have been really strong proponents of this. But I think that an elected official is a lot different than, say, an appointed police chief in the city or some other place where you can change a salary if things change. We're going to do a compensation study, and issues like this will be coming forward for our employees. I hope that folks won't support this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Lane, Mike Sigler.
Well, I'm glad, Mike spoke. I don't want to make this, I don't want to make this seem like I'm just responding to Mike. I mean, this is generally how I feel about the issue. I actually am glad that this was brought forward. It would be one thing if the pay wasn't so disparate between where the sheriff is and where the undersheriff is, and where, he is leading an organization. And when you lead the organization, one would generally think that there would be remuneration to pay for that added responsibility. And I understand we're going to be doing a compensation study. I'm glad that came up too, but I don't really need a study, I think, on this issue. I see it. It's not like it's something like I need somebody to come to me and say, oh, well, look at these numbers. I've got the numbers. I don't know what more a study is going to tell me. I mean, a $10,000 swing between those two positions is quite a bit. And I understand what Mike is saying. We've never done it before, but there are only two elected officials really that we control their budgets. And that's where we get our voice, is through their budgets. I can't go and tell the sheriff, I think you should be doing your job this way. The way we would address that is through our budget. And frankly, if we're looking at his budget and we're saying, wow, you really don't make enough money, that is in our purview. That's what we're in charge of. And I think this too, I'm going to put the military organization part to the side. I'm looking at this from a basic point of fairness. I mean, If none of those salaries had gone up in the sheriff's department, we really wouldn't be having this discussion. But they did go up. And so is it not fair to say, well, those salaries all went up underneath you. Sorry, you're locked into what it was 4 years ago, despite everything that's happened in the last 4 years. I mean, we're not operating in a vacuum. Things have happened. And I think that the sheriff deserves that kind of compensation, especially considering you can't really have people working for you making just a lot more than you when it's something that's not a specialized kind of position. I mean, one would understand if it was, we were looking for example, the head of mental health services, where the person had to be a doctor and had to have so much experience. And you'd say, yeah, that's probably the highest paid person in the county, perhaps. But in this instance, we have someone who's qualified, was elected to the position, and now the people that he's trying to lead are making, and it's not a little bit more, right? It's significantly more. We're talking almost double-digit percentage more. And that's something that we as elected officials, I think, need to address. I don't think that that's something that we should have not brought forward. That's absolutely something that's in our purview, and we can address it right now. So I don't know why we would wait for the compensation study when it's something that's so obvious to us. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike Sigler. Rich John?
I just wanted to go on record. I supported the resolution to raise the salary in the new term. And I have no quibble with our sheriff. I think he's generally doing a very good job. For all the reasons that Mike Lane stated, I'm deeply uncomfortable with proceeding to change a salary midterm and for an elected official. That just seems to open us up to criticism, and frankly, rightfully so, that we're changing the nature of the game midstream. Anyway, I will be voting against. Thank you.
We have Travis Brooks, Randy Brown, and Lee Shirtless.
So I just have, thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few questions to give me a better understanding. One, with the raise that would happen, the retroactive raise, what would the disparity be then between him and the folks under him? That's one. Two, did he give the undersheriff the raise? So if he gives the undersheriff a raise, can his raise then go up? I mean, can his rate then go up? Two, the last question would be, is the new pay that'll happen after the election, is that dependent on the comp study? That's two separate things, correct? Those would be the three questions.
I'm going to let the chair of budget, Deb Dolphin, respond to those.
Okay, thanks, Travis. I'm going to address the order because I probably can't remember your first question. But your last question, yes, the comp study is completely independent and a separate entity from the issue of the sheriff's salary. Your second question was whether the sheriff gave the undersheriff the raise. No, he did not. He asked that her position be reexamined by our human resources department in order to determine whether she was being compensated for the work she was actually doing. So they have a system in HR where they assign points to the duties that you're fulfilling, and then they base your salary on that. And what was your first question?
The first question was, with the 4% that the sheriff would get, does that close the gap between his?
No.
Okay.
No, because remember that 4%, all of the raises that the sheriff would get are the same raises that all of the employees in the patrol bargaining unit will also get under the new contract. So okay. All of their salaries will go up.
I question that, but the separate bargaining unit.
They all got raises, Mike. I mean, you can, Ruby might know if there's a serious question about that.
Ruby, would you help us on this?
Hi, I'd have to look because Road Patrol also got an increase, so I have to look and compare their salaries. But either way, you're starting at different levels, so whichever one is increased, it will still be a disparity between the sheriff and the undersheriff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a point of information just while we're on this.
Sure.
Is the sheriff's salary increase tied to the white collar bargaining unit contract or to the road patrol bargaining unit contract? Because it seems that the positions increases are tied to some bargaining unit. Is that a correct assumption? And which bargaining unit would that be?
I bet Lisa Holmes knows the answer to that question.
Yeah, so the management and confidential salaries are tied to the white-collar bargaining unit.
So would that also control the undersheriff's increase, Lisa? Okay,
that's
thank
correct.
You. So whatever the sheriff's going to get, the undersheriff is going to get as well. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay,
they're both management titles.
Okay, thank you.
Travis, did you have any other questions? Okay. Next is Randy Brown, Lee Shirtless, and Greg Muzzy.
Thank you. A little unfamiliar with this whole subject. I did look at the prior public meeting that they that you had on this subject. I'm struggling with it a little bit. I'm a little unclear on the 90 and the 91. I understand the undersheriff now is a is it class 91? Is he, is it,
no, she's a class 90.
Class 90. So he would be class 91.
Right.
So what is the range, if I can ask, for a class 90? What's the range? Is it a range or is it just this is the salary? How does it work?
Well,
you see, there's a range of your class. It's between here and here. Is that how it works? Or?
Ruby, can you help us out again?
Sure, hold on. I'm looking at it specifically. It's a higher work rate and a work rate. There's no range. After 9 months, you go to the work rate, and that's where you stay. But I'm looking, I only have on hand the 2021 rates, and I can give that to you.
Just something quick in here, Shauna.
Sure.
Can we make sure we're talking about the positions and not about him or her, that person? We're talking about the positions, I believe is what we want to do, right?
Right.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you.
Okay. For the undersheriff position at 90, great labor grade 90, the work rate is 111,571.20. That remember that's the 2020 rates. I don't have the 2021 as of yet. For the not grade 91, that would go to 122,740.80.
What about the 91, Ruby? Would you have that?
91, that is 91. The grade 91 for the 2020 rate is 122,740.
Okay, thank you.
And what is the current sheriff rated at? I mean, what's that?
He doesn't have a job grade rating. What he has is a salary, and it's about, excuse me, it's about 101.
I agree. I think the sheriff's doing a good job. It's not about that. I'm really struggling with the when you're elected at a salary, and it is what it is. So I've been in this situation. I've been hired where people made a lot more money than me, and I've dealt with it. It is what it is. I'm struggling to support something.
Thank you, Randy. Next is Lee Sertliff.
Just a few different thoughts on this. I understand where Mike and Rich are coming from on it. It is changing a longstanding precedent. I think the question that Randy just asked as to where the rating has been in the past and the fact that there has been no rating kind of underscores that the salary may have been set from time to time in an arbitrary manner and probably was done by comparing to other counties. Maybe not. But the basis that all of our employees in Tompkins County work under has to do with the ratings and classification system. And Ruby has just started to touch on that. I raised the question I think at the budget and capital personnel committee about getting a chance to kind of see where point factors lie, which positions fall within them and so on. The next part of it is that clearly if we're headed down the road of doing a compensation study, then there's some recognition that there are salaries in various positions that are not where they should be. Good or bad. And I am presuming that when we recognize and do those ratings that they're going to be addressed in a fairly timely manner and not held off till the next successor or term begins, whatever the case may be. I think that one thing that has caught my eye is we've looked at this is that the sheriff's union contract expired at the end of 2017. And you've obviously, the board, the legislature, administration, whomever, over the past 4 years have been working hard to get a new contract. The new contract has come in. A lot of thought went into that. Presumably, had that contract been effective on the 1st of January of 2018, you'd have taken a look at the whole organization, the whole department, and made adjustments then. I think that given that where that contract has ended up and with the management staff and the increases that have been given and the recognition and responsibilities that may have changed in that department, I don't think it's right. I don't think it's equitable to not make an adjustment when we know that it's seriously out of whack from where it should be. I will vote to support it. I understand very much the precedent that we're discussing, but I also know that Tompkins County has a history of correcting classifications, salary levels, when they realize that they're not where they should be.
Thank you, Lee. Next is Greg Mezzi and then Deborah Dolphin.
Just a quick question. In the conversation, the question on, you know, the sheriff position, you know, elevating the salary grade of the undersheriff, what's the process to have that position upgraded to a job grade 90? Is that an internal HR decision with approval from county administration, or is that something that came to the legislature for consideration?
I'm going to let Ruby answer that question because she's our HR maven.
The process for the reclass system really stops at the HR department. Once the position is reviewed, the new additions are reviewed, the job spec is revised, and we recommend reclass. And if the department head okays it, we go with it. At this point, we are looking to change the reclass system to add a few more levels of approval, including whether the money is available right then, approval from the department head and approval from the county admin if it's a department head level. But at this, right now, the policy just stops at the review of the job description and the HR department.
You know what? Hold on one second. Dominic, I want to see if we can make some adjustments here.
Can disable the chat and
Stop
the meeting, please.
These comments are violating our policy for public comment, which is criticizing unelected county employees.
And if they were here,
bye-bye, NS.
And if they were here, you know, we wouldn't allow people to keep yelling out. So if we could disable the chat, please, entirely, not just some people, but just disable it. Other municipality meetings I go to, they just disable the chat.
Yes, we've disabled the chat now that they've violated the rule. Thanks.
I also want to remind if the people that were doing that are at that, as mentioned at the very beginning of the meeting, we do have rules of this legislature. And if, in fact, you continue to do that, we do not have to allow public comment. It is a privilege to be able to speak on the floor of this legislature for public comment. We do not want to do that because we receive feedback from our constituents. However, we also do not want people abusing our staff, and we want people to listen to the rules of the legislature. Thank you, Dominic, for taking care of that. Okay.
If I can refer the legislature to Administrative Policy 0201, is regarding creating new positions, reclassifying existing positions, increasing or decreasing hours of positions and appeal process. That was effective 1981 and last revised in 2015. There's a reclassification section there that tells us about the point factor rating system, how we review the job description to determine if there are new duties, and then we say it's eligible for reclassification.
Greg?
Thank you, Ruby. I appreciate the background and thoughtful response. My other question or comment comes around the idea about changing an elected official salary midterm. The sheer fact that we have it tied, the increase is tied to a bargaining unit agreement, we are, in fact, changing the salary midterm, right? So by approving that contract and tying the salary increase to a bargaining unit agreement, we're changing it midterm. If people are opposed to changing a midterm, I think we should look at addressing all elected officials, you know, increases. And, you know, this is not like our position, which is clearly defined and, you know, we go and set that process out. And it's not tied to a bargaining unit. So the fact that we can do that, we are able to, and we have changed the sheriff's position salary by changing, you know, and approving new bargaining agreements. So just want to point that out. It's not a totally factual statement to say we're not changing that position salary midterm, because by approving a contract, we are, because those increases are tied to that contract. And we have the ability to negotiate what those increases are.
Thank you, Greg. We have Deb Dawson, Veronica, Mike Lane, and Amanda Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this distinction between elected officials and employees, in the case of both our sheriff and our county clerk, seems to me to be a false one, or at least misleading. There are electeds, like us legislators, who are generalists. I mean, we come in here and we try our best to represent our constituents, but we are not professionals. We don't run, administer, implement. We don't actually provide services to the county. We're supposed to be like the guiding hand, and our contributions are at the policy level and often at the political level. But our sheriff and our county clerk are functionally department heads. The sheriff heads a department, and it's not a small, insignificant, unimportant department. It's a really crucial department. And we have other department heads, and I won't name the departments because I don't want to run afoul of identifying anybody, but we have other department heads who are job grade 91s. And their departments are no more important, no more significant, and in some cases, not even as large as the sheriff's office. So I ask you all to consider that. You know, when we hire a department head and circumstances change over 4 years, we don't say, well, you accepted the job at this salary. Why the heck should we give you a raise? That's absurd. And to say that we're somehow changing the nature of the game midstream. Yeah, circumstances change the nature of the game midstream. COVID changed the nature of the game for all of us and for all of our employees. And reimagining public safety, the governor's executive order 203, that was a major game changer, especially for people in law enforcement. So I just ask that you consider, this is not something ordinarily I would be pushing, but we're in exceptional circumstances here. And I just don't understand why we would be giving shout outs to our employees, talking about how valuable they are and how they've, you know, risen to the challenge and they've continued to provide county services during COVID. And then we quibble about adjusting what I consider a really imbalanced salary structure within one department, just because the person that heads that department happens to have been elected rather than hired. Thank you all.
Thank you, Deborah. Veronica Pillar, Mike Lane, and Amanda Champion. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think clearly understand the argument for increasing the sheriff's salary as soon as possible, and it makes sense that we've, or wasn't me, you all have increased it for the next term. I despite hearing what Deb Dawson just said, I do still see a distinction between elected officials and other staff, like Mike and Rich were saying, partly because you think about, I mean, you had this example of you don't hire someone and say, well, your salary is what it is. We're never going to give you a raise. But most jobs don't have terms, right? You don't have this natural, like, reconfiguring, redetermining the salary period. The accountability structure is different because you are accountable to constituents, even though I hear that it's in a different way than we are. So that gives me pause for reasons that I'm not going to rehash, others said. The other thing that might not affect this very specifically, because this is just about one salary, is actually to Lee's point that there is likely a bunch of other, like, in maybe not inequity, like imbalance, like salaries that need to be corrected throughout the county. I imagine that's true. I imagine that's why we're doing the compensation study. And so I see the argument that we should correct an imbalance as soon as possible when we have it. But I'm also really concerned that we're doing this. We're kind of like jumping through hoops. I realize we already jumped through them at this point. It's not that hard to vote yes. But to increase the compensation of one of the more powerful people in the county, one of the like top level folks, and that corrects an imbalance where it sits, but it's not really helping like imbalance and inequity like on a systemic level. I think this is always where we tend to look, like someone in the middle range has their salary bumped up and then we bump up higher, and what happened to people lower down. So I don't know the details here, but that's a concern I have. And with the bringing up the reimagining public safety, I think like also one theme that came up in that process was questioning the, as people mentioned, the military structure of the sheriff's department, and questioning whether that these sort of militarized systems to try to keep us safe are really what's going to be helpful here. And I know we're not litigating the system with this resolution, but you know, these kind of hierarchical, like, force-driven structures are like created and sustained by all these little decisions. So just adding more money into the sheriff's department in service of hierarchy is something that also concerns me. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Thank you, Veronica. Mike Lane?
Just wanted to reply briefly to Greg's point. Yes, we've already said that there will be a change based on the white-collar contract over the 4 years of the sheriff's term. That was set, and that was the mechanism that was set before people made their decision to run for sheriff. They knew that it was, that there would be a salary and that there would be increases based on whatever happened with the white-collar contract. To change it now still makes a change that was not anticipated, not in front of the candidates who ran for sheriff 4 years ago, 3 years ago.
Thank you, Mike. Amanda Champion.
Yeah, thanks. I just on the idea that this, you know, changes the precedent, or, you know, whatever, some, you know, future legislatures are going to look back and say, you know, oh, they didn't do it the same way. I guess I don't really see, I mean, they'll have their own situations. They'll have their own things that they're responding to. They'll have their own pandemics and whatever. And I don't think a situation like this is going to come up every term. It's not going to open the floodgates to suddenly lots of people. I mean, we only have two elected officials that we set the salaries for. I mean, we set our own, but, you know, that would be another huge discussion to change our own salaries, and I don't think anybody's suggesting that. So we have two elected officials that we want to make sure are being compensated, and I don't really think it changes the precedent. I think we're making a decision on this one instance right now. And future legislatures can make whatever decisions they want.
Thank you, Amanda. Randy Brown.
Thank you. This is educational. It's good to know that there are other department heads are 91s, or whatever that means. For me, it's money. I look at where money is spent, and I know how much money is spent in youth programs at Newfield and Enfield, and this would be equal to one of them that raise. So for me, it's really about money. I'm sure that the responsibility is very grand and important. And you'll find that it's always going to come back to the money for me in most decisions I make. So.
Thanks, you miser. No, I'm just joking.
You're just spoken.
Yeah.
Dan corrected me. We actually also set the DA's salary. So we have three elected officials that we set salaries for.
Okay. Greg, and then I will go.
The DA is mandated by the state what we have to set for them.
Yeah, he gets paid what the judges get paid, and he gets paid better than anybody else in the county, I believe.
That's a two, though.
Yeah.
Okay, Greg, and then is there anyone else? Okay.
All right, thank you for the opportunity to ask another question. I have, a question and a comment. Would the sheriff's position be considered in the wage study that we're conducting?
Ruby is nodding yes.
It would be. I definitely hear what Veronica is saying about correcting imbalances, you know, system-wide, and I think that that's a great opportunity for that. I think what I heard the policy or my interpretation of the policy for increasing the pay of a position is the department head, you know, goes to HR, there's review, and then that if there's room in the budget and it's agreed upon, we are the mechanism for the sheriff, right? So in essence, we are following somewhat what the general spirit of the policy to increase the pay of a position, right, is go to those that control the budget, have, you know, them discuss it, and then approve it or deny it. And so I do think that there is a mechanism for this, and I don't think it's necessarily out of line to ask this question midstream because we've already agreed on the policy. And then if we're including the sheriff's position in the compensation study, there's an element where the position is being treated as an employee position and as the sheriff's position, so as an elected position. So I don't think it's unfair to take this moment to really follow the spirit of our internal pay policy and have the discussion, see if it makes sense within our budget, recognize any financial, you know, implications that it may have, any employment, morale, whatever issues it may have, and then make the decision. So from that standpoint, I feel comfortable supporting this.
Thank you, Greg. So I am going to weigh in here, and then Travis, if you could wrap us up on the debate. I agree with Deborah, but I also see points that Veronica's made. And I know that you're concerned about the imbalance here. I feel that it doesn't matter if the person is elected or if they are hired. The reality of our law enforcement is that it is a very strict chain of command. And I think what's important to recognize is, to some extent, it's insulting whenever a subordinate is making more than the director or the person that's in charge. This position has a ton of responsibility. Whenever I asked Derek about the hours that he puts in, there are hardly any weeks that he puts in under 45 or 50 hours. I know that we readjusted the clerk's salary last week from 35 to 40, and there was an increase in her salary based on the hourly rate. If we were to do that with the sheriff's salary as well,
I'm sure that we would see a large increase. The one thing that I think is important to remember as well is that the sheriff's position does not qualify for overtime. So even though this position does the overtime, they are not receiving extra dollars. As far as I'm concerned, this is basically a checks and balances here. This is our chance to get it right. And the one thing that I would let the new people know is that we do have the ability to override salaries. They're called red lines. And if we notice that there is a position that is hard to recruit, we do it in public health, we do it in mental health, we do, in fact, have the ability to go in and offer the person more money. This is a tool that we have in our toolbox. And I think the circumstances with COVID, with us engaging in reimagined public safety, this is definitely a chance for us to adapt to that and to get the salary at the right pay grade. And from here on, it should be kosher. Okay, Travis, wrap us up here.
I'll do my best. So I need to be clear before I make a decision. The idea of this is to have the sheriff be at a rate that's higher than his subordinates. Yes. This is not an issue in regards to how much work the sheriff is doing, whether they need to have a comp study of their job, but to make the sheriff's wages higher than the subordinate. If that's the case, then we have to stop doing a few things and making it seem as if it's about other things. If we're talking about salary employees, which I'm one, how many salary employees in the county work more than 40 hours a week? Because if that becomes a question, then we need to look at all salary employees that work more than 40 hours a week and not the sheriff. That's insulting to the rest of the county employees that are salary employees that work more than 40 hours work. And I would bet that on a regular basis, we have a handful of salary employees working more than 40 hours a week. So if that's an argument, then we need to start talking about our other salary employees. But if this is purely about having a individual who runs a department make more than their subordinates, then let's just keep it at that and make that decision and stop throwing in stuff that really is not about what I understand what Deb is trying to make happen, and that is correct an issue, but we're adding a lot of other pieces to this that don't exist.
Thank you, Travis. Deborah Dawson, you're it.
I understand your point, Travis, but we have two different tools for addressing those two issues, even though they're related. You know, we've got the compensation study that's going to address the imbalances at the lower level. And because there are tons of employees who are at those levels that may be unpaid, that's why we're doing a compensation study. We can't just pass a blanket resolution here in legislative chambers, whereas to adjust the imbalance in the sheriff's department and make sure that our sheriff is always being paid more than all the people that work for him or her, we can do that by passing this law.
Thank you, Deborah. Okay, thank you all. That was a very good and respectful debate. Let's do a roll call.
Randy Brown?
No.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
No.
Rich John?
No.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
No.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
No.
Lee Shurtleff?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
No.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
We have 8 ayes, 6 noes.
That passes. Thank you all. Deborah, did you want to give a report for Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee?
I don't really have anything much to report other than to welcome Uwe Shirtless and Greg Meese, who will be replacing their predecessors, Glenn Morey and Martha Robertson. And I'm sorry, Greg, I keep forgetting you're a Meese, not a Meese. So anyhow, welcome aboard, and I think it's the best committee. But.
And I was calling Greg Meese as well until I called his cell phone and heard his voicemail and realized I was calling him the wrong name. So sorry about that.
I should know better by now, though.
My entire life is in the phone.
Okay. Thank you, Deborah. Next is the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee.
A break tonight?
We can do a break, but we do only have three more committees.
Executive session.
Yeah, well, we will take a break after the committees. What do you guys want to do?
Let's just...
Okay. Yep, that's what I figured. Okay. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Henry Granison, Chair.
No report.
Thank you. Housing Economic Development Committee, Mike Sigler, Vice Chair.
Well, we're meeting on the 27th. It's going to be great. It's 9:30 in the morning if you guys want to come. So it's the last time that... You know, housing will be a part of that committee, so come and enjoy. We're going to build a lot of housing that day.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And are there any questions for Mike? Okay. Let's see here. Downtown Facilities Committee, Rich John, Vice Chair.
Yeah, the committee, I believe, has just recently evaporated. We have not met. So I'll only talk for 20 minutes before we take a break.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I have nothing to report.
Thank you. Any questions for Rich John? So let's go ahead and do minutes, and then we will take a break. If I could have a mover for minutes of the previous meeting, January 4th, 2022, moved by Veronica Pillar, seconded by Ann Corman. Any questions or comments? I see none. We'll do a roll call.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Meese?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
Yes.
Lee Shirtless?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you.
I would do the motion.
Okay. If I can have a motion to go into executive session, please. Greg Meese, seconded by Deborah Dawson.
For the purpose of discussing personnel issues involving a specific employee.
We will not be taking action.
She did.
And we'll do a roll call for that. Just hold one second.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Meese?
Yes.
The Pillar?
Yes.
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a break. And why don't we plan on reconvening at 8:20?